Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's our monthly book show, and the theme is democracy and civics. Joining us, Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Books Shop in Sandwich. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Mindy.
And Dave Vieira, Falmouth Town Moderator and State Rep. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, Ray, this was your idea just before the election. We're going to talk democracy.
Yes, I considered choosing like a, you know, spooky murder mystery Halloween
thing. We do it every year.
And then it's like, that's not what we're thinking about right now. So why not just dive into what's on everybody's mind?
All right. So what's your first book?
So my first book is Tyranny of the Minority by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Zablot. And in this book, Levitsky and Zablot describe how a small organized group can wield significant power and influence, often at the expense of broader public interests. And it also highlights the influence of powerful interest groups and lobbyists who can manipulate political processes to advance narrow agendas. The authors argue that when minority factions dominate, it can undermine democratic principles, leading to disillusionment among the general populace and eroding trust in institutions. So, for example, despite widespread bipartisan public support for various gun control measures, such as universal background checks, the NRA has successfully blocked significant reforms on gun control. And this is largely due to their ability to galvanize political support and lobby legislators. So this is a really scary thought that the general population could think one way, and then what's actually happening in policy can be so different due to small groups. And the authors stress the importance of active citizen participation to counteract the influence of entrenched minority interests. Yeah. And active citizen participation is going to be a theme in a lot of the books that I talk about today. And it seemed kind of obvious, but as I was reading all these books, I really realized that is the most important thing that we need to do as...
Yeah, that book... is a must read. It really makes you think. There's a lot in that book to think about. And it was interesting going, they talk a lot about history of democracy in a lot of other countries and what's happened. And they wrote a book before that, How Democracy Dies. And then January 6th happened. And then they wrote this book. And there was a section in there, and I can't remember the year, but it was when there was a march on Parliament in France. And you're reading it, I'm like, oh my God, this reads like January 6th. And it was like, I don't know, 1700, 1800. I can't remember how long ago it was. But there's a lot of a really interesting history in that book as well. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's Tyranny of the Minority. So thank you for that one. All right, Dave, what's your first book? You're going way back to the beginning.
So, yeah. So it's interesting that Ray mentioned citizen participation, because I'm going to start with the citizen participation. Being honored to be a semi-quincentennial commissioner here in the Commonwealth celebrating the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution, I'm going to start with a novel by Howard Fast, April Morning. And it's the coming-of-age story of a young man named Adam Cooper who, the night before the muster at Lexington, has some challenges in his family and his personal life and decides to try to prove to his father who he really is and that he's a man. And he goes through the next 24 hours on the front lines of the first day in many people's minds of the American Revolution. And it is the only book, when I read it in high school, I read it freshman year, where I cried at the end of the book.
Mm. Powerful.
It was. It was powerful. The story itself and the coming-of-age portion of it was powerful. But just putting into context what families and young people were going through at the time of the birth of our nation really was, for me, moving. And for me, it kind of set me on a trajectory. I brought copies of all of my books except for that one because my 12-year-old daughter is attempting to read it right now and I couldn't find it this morning. But yeah, Howard Fast's April Morning about that first day of the revolution.
So this morning we're going your journey on democracy as well.
Yeah, so I was trying to get a little theme with some of my books here, and my theme is my journey through democracy. Yeah. And I'll be talking about some biographies that have impacted me individually and as a public official.
All right. What's next, Ray?
I love that you brought a novel, too.
I have two, actually.
Yeah, yeah, I didn't even get to novel. Like, I had it in my mind, oh, I should find a novel, but didn't get to it. So thank you for that. So my next book is Common Sense to Save Democracy by local author Steve Kramer. And I have a couple local author books today, which is great. I love to see local people writing about these things. So this is Steve Kramer is a former assistant attorney general of Massachusetts. And it's a short collection of essays modeled after Thomas Paine's 1776 pamphlet, Common Sense. And it offers a nonpartisan guide to several policy issues in need of common sense solutions. The key to achieving these solutions, according to Kramer, is the willingness to compromise and seek common ground. And Kramer also calls for a renewal of citizen activism. He covers issues like term limits, civility, immigration, abortion, gun control, the housing crisis.
That's a lot in that little book.
It's amazing. It's like, 38 pages. But so each one is basically a page. Mm-hmm. So it's for anyone who doesn't like to read huge tomes about this kind of thing, it's a great little introduction to thinking about politics. And he offers very practical, common sense solutions. And he's very straightforward, and he really is nonpartisan, looking at flaws and strengths in both sides. He hearkens to bipartisan collaborations like the 2013 Border Security, Economic Opportunity, and Immigration Modernization Act, which was produced by the Gang of Eight, which consisted of four Democrats and four Republicans, that overwhelmingly passed in the Senate. It was an omnibus bill covering many different immigration issues, and it passed in the Senate, but the Speaker of the House did not bring it into the House, so it never got passed.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, gives light to the fact that we could be very successful if we collaborated more.
Yeah, so it's Common Sense to Save Democracy by Steve Kramer. All right. And what's next on your list, Dave?
So I love how this is unscripted, but it plays off itself, right?
Yeah, I know. Well, that's the beauty of the book show. It's like, we should tell people, there's no scripts. I mean, we have the books on the table in front of us, and we just talk.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about this
you guys didn't,
finding
you,
common
you,
ground. We did, I mean, we emailed
didn't talk
once,
beforehand.
And I look forward to seeing you.
Yeah.
But you're talking about bipartisanship, working together, collaboration, and all that. And my next book is Man of the House by Thomas P. O'Neill, Tip O'Neill, who was the first Democratic Speaker of the Massachusetts House of Representatives, which I serve in, and then went on to become the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. And in this book, which I also read in high school, part of it I read at the State House when I was waiting in line for Student Government Day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about his career from the first and only election he ever lost, which was for the school committee. and when he learned the lesson, all politics is local, which everyone credits him with that phrase, and it's actually not his phrase. It's a lesson that his father taught him, and I just want to
read a
portion of that to dispel the rumor that it came from Tip himself. This was the only race I ever lost in my life, but in the process, I learned two extremely valuable lessons. During the campaign, my father had left me to my own devices, but when it was over, he pointed out that I had taken my own neighborhood for granted. He was right. I had received a tremendous vote in the other sections of the city, but I hadn't worked hard enough in my own backyard. Let me tell you something that I learned years ago, he said. All politics is local.
Mm,
and that's
where
Tip got the advice. So it goes on through his career, and there's the chapter towards the end is about his work with Ronald Reagan, where they were obviously ideologically on different sides of the aisle. They went to battle in the public eye on certain issues, but then they also found ways to compromise and to come together. And there was a phrase where it would call over to the White House and say, is it after 6 o'clock? And sometimes it would be in the middle of the day. And if it was after 6 o'clock, it meant we were going to have a personal conversation. And this wasn't part of our political arena. I had this book actually signed by Tip O'Neill. I had the honor to sit with him in the front row of the Barnstable Superior Courthouse right after I finished reading it, when he swore in Jack DeMello, who was the sheriff from Falmouth. And I worked for Jack at age 17. And I asked Mr. O'Neill, I said, what advice do you have for a young guy trying to get into politics? And he said, son, always tell the truth. You'll never have to remember what you said.
Good advice.
And I will never forget that. Yeah, and he said, I'm writing another book called All Politics is Local. When it's done, let Jackie know. We'll go play golf in Harwich. And he died 2 weeks after the book was released, and I never got to play golf with Tip O'Neill.
Ray?
So my next one is on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century by Timothy Snyder. Snyder examines 20 lessons from totalitarian regimes throughout the 20th century. It's a guide to recognizing and resisting authoritarianism in today's society. It's a very short read. It's only 128 pages. And he provides practical advice such as the necessity of defending institutions, doing your own research, and the value of participating in public life. And one of the lessons that really stood out to me was chapter 9, entitled Make Eye Contact and Small Talk. It was totally unexpected, and I'm so glad it was in there, because I can be so totally introverted when I'm out in public a lot of times, and I tend to clam up, and I don't make eye contact, and I don't talk to people when I don't have to. And this book made me realize the deeper importance of doing that. It's not just to be nice and to have a sense of community, but it also can safeguard against the fear and isolation and alienation that often comes up in totalitarian regimes. So it has those little things, making eye contact and small talk, actually have a huge importance. That really resonated with me.
And the name of the book again, and the author?
On Tyranny by Timothy Snyder.
And we should say, we'll have a list of all the books that we talk about this morning later today on our website, capeandislands.org. And we're wondering if you have some thoughts on our theme this morning, democracy and civics. You have a book you'd like to recommend for our list? Give us a call. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It is our monthly book show. Our theme this month is democracy and civics. With us is Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich, and Dave Vieira, Falmouth Town moderator and state rep. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Dave, what's your next book in your journey through democracy?
So my next book goes back over 2,000 years.
It's, oh, my.
it's Aeschylus's trilogy, the Oresteia, particularly the Eumenides. And this was a required reading in Western legal tradition when I was at American University in D.C. And to be able to go back before Christ's birth and to look at the stories that were told in a poetic form that have a direct lineage to our current system of justice within our democratic institutions. You know, the Furies are the ones that are out there trying to get revenge, you know, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth type of thing. And this idea that democracy will not pervade, justice will not pervade, society will not continue if it's this unfettered, violent retribution for acts taken against individuals or families, right? And so the Furies are out stirring everybody up, and there's this essence of, we need to stop that. Someone has to be able to codify decisions made when someone does wrong against an individual or a society. And so we have court procedures, oaths of office, juries, reverence. All these things come from the Eumenides, and particularly the issue around the death penalty, around if you kill someone who killed your family member, then another family member from the other side is going to come back and kill you. So whether you believe in the death penalty or not, or you have life in prison, the idea is that it is a state-sanctioned societal decision that's made equitably. And so there are many different types of translations. Recommendation is actually a Penguin classic. It's Robert Fangel's translation, because he really takes the essence of the poetic style of the Greek and actually brings it in a way that you don't lose any of the richness of the text.
It's hard to do.
It is. Yeah. It is. Because I've read some of the other ones, and I'm like, what happened here? And then I read his, and I'm like, oh, I get it now.
All right, so the name of the book again is?
Is Aeschylus's trilogy, The Oresteia, and particularly the third part of the trilogy, The Eumenides.
Thank you. Ray.
So, very different. My next one is Presidential Elections and Other Cool Facts by Syl Sobel. And this is a children's book. It's for ages 7 and up. And it's very clear and easy to understand language about the basics of the American election process. And it'd be great. It'd be a great book to read with your child because you can both learn things. It includes fun facts like the oldest and youngest presidents, and a famous first section in which I learned that the first woman to run for president was in 1872, Victoria Woodhull.
Oh, I haven't heard much about her, have we?
Yeah. And the first African American to run for president was in 1904,
wow.
George Edwin Taylor. So those were some pretty surprising facts. It explains the Electoral College, including a section about the five times presidential candidates have won the majority of votes but still lost the election. And I didn't realize that there have been candidates who have won the most votes in both the popular and electoral votes, but still lost because they didn't win a majority of the electoral votes, which can happen if there are more than two candidates running.
What do you say the age is for that group, for that book?
7 and up,
okay.
About.
Yeah. I need that book.
Yeah, it's great.
I love that.
Nice illustration.
I love anything with cool facts.
Yeah.
All right. So Richard wrote, Richard Hofstadter's anti-intellectualism in American life won the, I'm not the only one who can't spit out words today, right? Won the 1964 Pulitzer Prize. Considering the state of affairs in American politics today, the book is somewhat prophetic. Yes, thank you, Richard, for that one. And
good
then,
call, Richard. I got that one on my bookshelf as well.
Oh, you know, yeah, you've got a big bookshelf. I don't even know where you put all those books. 3,000 books you said you have in your book. Okay. How many do you have in the store? Right? A lot.
A few more than that.
And then Daniel writes, this is a fantastic and easy read that all Americans should read. It's the Bill of Obligations, the 10 Habits of Good Citizens, a provocative guide to how we must re-envision citizenship if American democracy is to survive. That's by Richard Haas. Thank you, Dan, for that. If you have an idea for a book that fits our theme this morning, democracy and civics, send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org, or you can give us a call at 866-999-4626. What have you got next, Dave?
Well, I guess I have to default to the classic Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, right? Mm-hmm. So I served for a number of years as a deputy sheriff here in Barnstable County, and Alexis de Tocqueville was sent to America to actually study our criminal justice system. And when he got here, he was just enamored by this young, burgeoning democracy and learning from the local level to the national level. He had conversations with John Quincy Adams to learn about slavery. And so he ended up writing Democracy in America rather than actually a treatise on the criminal justice system in the United States. And I actually have a little quote of his on my orientation paper that I use for new town meeting members. But one of the interesting things, being the town moderator, is his being enamored, as I was when I went to my first town meeting, with the local form of government that we had in the United States. And he had a maxim that he puts out in part one, that everyone is the best and sole judge of his own private interest, and that society has no right to control a man's actions unless they are prejudicial to the commonweal or unless the commonweal demands his help. The New Englander is attached to his township, not so much so because he was born in it, because it is a free and strong community of which he is a member and which deserves the care spent in managing it, hence the open town meetings. The township of New England is so constituted as to excite the warmest of human affections. Now, I think when we get out of town meeting, we usually go and have something to drink, a cup of coffee after town meeting. Mm-hmm. And we have folks that are on both sides of an issue at town meeting, but they're not affiliated to a political party. It's not Democrats and Republicans. They are people that were for this bylaw, people that were against this bylaw, or maybe it's an appropriation. And that affection of being part of the community, they come together and they joke about it. Hey, you won this time, or I won this one, or hey, I'm glad we're on the same side of this one, because there's none of that partisanship, right? Mm-hmm. And it's that human affection that de Tocqueville talks about, of it's our community, we're doing the best for our neighbors, and we're directly involved in it. And so that's why for the last 26 years, I've loved being the Falmouth Town moderator, because it brings to me that human affection of my neighbors.
Yeah. You mentioned that you said your first town meeting, you were enamored. What were you, 10?
I was 12.
Actually. 12, okay, I was close.
I've been to every town meeting since April 1987.
Wow. Yeah. Right.
Except for when I was in college. I read it in the Enterprise.
Okay.
Town meeting, going to town meeting was one of my favorite parts about living in Sandwich. As a kid. I mean,
really?
My parents would take me. We had to go. We were assigned to for civics class to go. And then I just went when I was older as well.
See, maybe we need to be bringing more kids to town meeting, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's why when the Lawrence School here in Falmouth applied a number of years ago for the Innovation School, I helped them write their student government, which is a town meeting. They elect a moderator. They elect town meeting members from each of their advisories, and they conduct a town meeting so they can learn
that
how the system
awesome.
Works.
That's so
yeah.
cool.
Right.
So my next book is Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? By Alexander Kesar. And I love the title of this book. It's fascinating because since the birth of the Electoral College in 1787, it's been contested, and they never really wanted to do it. It was always a compromise, and by 1800, they were trying to get rid of it, basically. And so it's just fascinating that for over 200 years, most people do not like the system, and yet we still have it. So for many of the framers of the Constitution, the Electoral College was not their preferred electoral system. It was compromised between a popular vote and one in which the legislature determines the president. And they didn't like either of those options, so they sort of went with this one. And because in effect, or in theory at least, the Electoral College was a temporary legislature. It was a group of people who would assemble only once and would not have ongoing dealings with the national government. So it prevented corruption and influence, undue influence. And it would disband as soon as it carried out its one function. However, the Electoral College brought into the presidential election the advantages that have been granted to small states and slave states with the three-fifths rule in terms of representation in Congress. And in so doing, it gave both of these groups influence that was not proportionate to their voting populations. And also thanks to the emergence of political parties, we were talking about the downfalls of partisanships earlier. By 1800, the electoral system was functioning totally differently from how the framers had envisioned. The framers actually thought that the electors would deliberate in the gathering that they had, but that has proven to not happen at all. They basically just vote with their party, and that's that.
It's a big book, so imagine a lot of history in that one, right?
Yes, yeah. This is definitely
not a quick read.
Easy read, but it's fascinating. Yeah.
And the name again, and author?
Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College, Alexander Kasar.
All right. Philip writes in, I'd like to make sure that the book The Power Broker by Robert Caro is on your list. It's the biography of Robert Moses and how he exercised power to build infrastructure in the city of New York and elsewhere in New York without ever having been elected to any public office. This year is the 50th anniversary of its publication. Robert Caro is a magnificent writer and researcher. And Philip, it is on the list. Thank you for sharing that. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, David, what's next?
So the next one is Profiles in Courage.
Oh, yeah.
By then-Senator John Kennedy. It is a series of vignettes of various individuals that stood outside of the mainstream to stand up for what is right in our democracy. Some of them winning for what they stood up for, others not, and really defining in many cases, as John Adams did, the course of our history. Again, he wrote this while he was still a senator, and he also wrote another one I'm going to talk about later. But the idea that a United States senator, then to become president, was diving into this level of history and writing as a way to express his thoughts about where he wanted the country to go, and then rising to the level of the presidency, I think had a lot to do with his writings as Americans received them. And I'm going to give you an example. All the Portuguese Americans on Cape Cod will recognize this. You know, in my grandparents' house, there was a picture of the Pope, and mm-hmm. there was a picture of John Kennedy. And it was regardless if you were a Republican or a Democrat, there was a picture of John Kennedy, as there is in my district office, the one that was in my grandmother's house in the form of a tapestry. And my grandmother signed this copy of the book. She had it in her secretary when she passed away. I was able to acquire it with the family. And let's just say folks in my family didn't really read books. But my grandmother had a copy of Profiles in Courage.
Yeah.
And I said, well, if this is like one of the few books she ever read, I need to read this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. And it starts with the opening line. This is a book about the most admirable of human virtues, courage. Grace under pressure, Ernest Hemingway defined it. And we know the long history of Hemingway and President Kennedy. So now we have the Profiles in Courage Award. The family every year at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston recognizes current day individuals from either political party that have stood up for what is right and have defined democracy in America.
Oh. All right. That's Profiles in Courage. Thank you. Right.
Next one is The Leadership Journey, How Four Kids Became President by Doris Kearns Goodwin. And Doris Kearns Goodwin is obviously an amazing writer. She wrote Team of Rivals, No Ordinary Time, many others, many political biographies. And she, this one's for children, about ages 8 to 12. And she tells the life stories of four U.S. presidents, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon B. Johnson. And she explores the qualities and the experiences that shape effective leadership. And it's a beautiful book. It has illustrations throughout, and it's written in a narrative style, so it's very engaging for young people. And she really emphasizes the importance of personal experiences, both triumphs and failures, in shaping a leader's character and their approach to governance. So, for example, Franklin Roosevelt's experience with polio forced him to be adaptable and find new ways to navigate his life and his politics. And it helps him develop a deep empathy for others who endure hardships, and it really strengthened his resolve and determination throughout his life. So it's very inspiring for young people and relatable. And she highlights how successful leaders build strong relationships and connect with people on a personal level, and also examines other things like crisis management, collaboration, all types of different themes. Very comprehensive, and it's interesting to see what the choices of presidents that she chose. Mm.
And what's the age for that? You said it's
8 to 12.
8 to 12. And you want? It's interesting because you say 8 to 12, mm-hmm. but I bet adults could read that.
Oh,
and I mean, they always say like definitely. Young adult or, you know, kids books. And I'm finding as I'm reading books with my grandson, I'm learning things that I didn't know.
Absolutely,
right?
Yes.
And it's not boring. It's not like you're looking at some little kid's, you know, board book or something. They can, especially with a writer like Doris Kearns Goodwin. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It's comprehensible, but.
So we're going to say 8+.
Yeah, sure.
Did she write an adult version of this as well?
Of this book, I don't think so.
No. Okay. Yeah. No. Okay, so that's, again, the title. It's Doris Kearns Goodwin, who, of course, is fabulous.
Yes, yeah. The Leadership Journey.
Leadership Journey. All right. Next, David.
So the next one is a biography of Arthur Fleming, Crusader at Large, written by his wife, Bernice, who I had the honor of meeting after Arthur had passed away. He was the first director of a public affairs program at the American University in Washington, which became the School of Public Affairs, which I graduated from. And Arthur had an interesting career, being a bureaucrat and really focusing on the day-to-day mechanics of democracy, of making sure that particularly the federal government had a system of merit-based advancement, equality for those that were applying to be in the workforce. And so he started off as a commissioner for the Civil Service Commission. But as you read through and as his wife observed the speeches he gave and the projects that he was involved in, when you think of democracy and you think of politics and all that, you think of the elected officials and, you know, other folks that we've talked about today. But when you look at Arthur Fleming's life, you look at someone who was off the radar screen, but was influential all the way up to the presidency, working directly with the president on you know, reorganizing the workforce after the Second World War, making sure that there was integration of women and minorities into the workforce, fighting for those equalities within the workforce. Not only because it's right, but because the product of those agencies is better when it's reflective of its constituency, which is the diversity of America. And in the end, before he went off to become a college president, he served with the Civil Rights Commission. And there, a very high-profile case for those that might remember of he was a Republican, served through Republican and Democratic administrations, but was removed from office by President Reagan mm-hmm. because some may have thought he went too far to try to protect the rights of others and to fight for equality and justice. And at American University, there's one student chosen every year to receive the Arthur Fleming Award for their work on civil rights and civil justice. And I was honored to have received that award, and that's where I got the copy of the book and got to meet Bernice.
And the book, again, is?
Is Arthur Fleming, Crusader at Large by his wife, Bernice Fleming.
And our monthly book show, our theme this month is Democracy and Civics. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a suggestion for us, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It is our monthly book show, and our theme this month is Democracy and Civics. If you have a book you'd like to share with us, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. You can also send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Richard in Wellfleet writes, Kennedy's book is not without fault. His glorification of racist, slave-owning Confederate Jim Crow father Lucius Lamar is shameful. Richard, thanks for sharing that. Joan in Chatham writes, this is a wonderful poem by Daniel Waters from his book Remembering the Islander. It's called Before a Town Meeting. Very funny and true. Joan, thank you for that suggestion. And again, we'll have a list of all of the books that we talk about this morning, including our suggestions from listeners at our website later today. We got to pull it all together at capeandislands.org. With us this morning is Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich and Dave Vieira, Falmouth Town Moderator and State Rep. Dave, what's next on your list?
So I'm going to go back to a novel actually written in 1947 by Baltazar Lopes. This novel was written to show the struggles of Cape Verdean individuals that lived in Cape Verde under the Portuguese rule, the colonial rule, and the dictatorship also of the Salazar regime. And the reason why I chose this book and its connection back here to Southeastern Massachusetts and our community is that in today's political world, we're talking about the future of democracy and immigration and why do people come to America? How do they come to America? And this story really sets in a heartfelt way the reasons why a family or an individual decides to leave their country and come to America. And the young man is named Chiquinho. And Chiquinho ended up at the end of the novel living in New Bedford, Massachusetts, of all places. And the story was translated into many languages, but not English, until just a few years ago, right before COVID, by a team of folks, including Carlos Almeida from Bristol Community College and Anna Klabuka from Wisconsin. And so this story really tells why folks want to strive for democracy, because they were living under a dictatorship in Portugal. They were living under the hard conditions of drought and famine. And for those that live in southeastern Massachusetts, where we have a rich Cape Verdean population, this novel will give you a sense of their culture. It'll give a sense of some of what, even today, some of their family members that are still in Cape Verde are dealing with. And it's interesting that Baltazar Lopes wanted to write a follow-up novel called A Cushnet Avenue. And A Cushnet Avenue is where most of the Cape Verdeans that came to New Bedford lived. And so he wanted to come to New Bedford for a year and live there so that he could then write the novel of what happened to Chiquinho when he came to the United States. And he was never allowed, he was living in Lisbon at the time, he was not allowed to get papers to leave the country under the dictatorship. Salazar would not allow him to leave. Now, Chiquinho in Portuguese is required reading in Cabo Verde. And a young man, José Cabral, who's not young anymore, he's older than me now, he decided he wanted to write that book. And just a couple years ago, A Cushnet Avenue has been released. And it's only in Portuguese, so I can't read it yet. But when they translate it, I will. I should be able to speak Portuguese, but I only do when I stub my toe.
Right.
So my next one is by another local author, Ronald Gruner, and it's called We the Presidents. And it is 600 pages, but it reads really fast. It covers all 46 presidents. So each president he does it in about 30 pages. And it's very engaging. It's funny. And you definitely learn a lot. It would even be a good coffee table book because you can just pick it up and pick a president and read a little about them.
So is it personal stuff about them?
It's both. I mean, it focuses on their presidential career, but also their personality, their personal experiences that kind of shape that as well. And there's a really funny anecdote. There's lots of funny anecdotes, but one of them was about Calvin Coolidge, who was known for his dry sense of humor. And one time at a dinner party, a guest bet that they could get Calvin Coolidge to say more than two words, and Coolidge said, "You lose."
That's funny.
So it definitely makes the presidents seem human and relatable and very fun to read.
And again, the title and author?
It is We the Presidents by Ronald Gruner.
Stephen in Chatham writes, the book Tyranny of the Minority says that we need to improve the current system of democracy. Yesterday, the White House released a draft for the public to comment on the way that federal agencies engage in public in their decision-making process. Think Cape Cod Canal Bridges. To comment on the proposed policy, go to performance.gov. Stephen, thanks for that. What's next on your list, David?
Am I only going to be able to get one more in?
Oh, no, we got time for
it. Oh, okay, so then I'll do two. So the next one would be Bridging the Divide, My Life by Senator Edward Brooke. You know, Senator Brooke was the first popularly elected African-American to the United States Senate from Massachusetts. He had also served as the first minority attorney general in Massachusetts. And he was a member of my party, the Republican Party. And I got the honor to meet him during the nomination convention for Paul Cellucci when Paul was running for governor here in the Commonwealth. And this was right after I got back from college. It was my first convention. And here I am, you know, meeting this icon of American politics who came from Massachusetts. And the story that he tells of his career in the book and the story that he told us at the convention is one that I think of constantly. It's the one where you take the edge off of rhetoric. It's the one where you seek common ground, and we've talked about compromise and how this whole democratic experience works, right? The difference between a town meeting and the difference between the United States Congress, right, mm-hmm. where you have all of the rancor and the hyper-partisanship at the national level, and then you've got folks that agree on one issue and disagree on another at the town meeting, right? And Ed really gave us, Senator Brooke gave us, in the book and on the floor, a challenge. And the challenge was really in order for our party, the Republican Party in Massachusetts, to be relevant and to continue, it was to meet the needs of the people. And that is what he tried to do his entire career, whether it was through targeted prosecutions as Attorney General and representing the Commonwealth, through his advocacy as a United States Senator, or in the charitable works that he did. He also served in the United States military, and he dealt with a lot of discrimination personally as a member of the Army. And when he returned, that really set his focus on making sure that what happened to him wouldn't happen to others. And again, bridging the divide. Mm-hmm. I think just the title in and of itself is where America needs to be today.
All right. Thanks, Ray.
So the next one is another Timothy Snyder. It's his latest one, and it's called On Freedom. And it's sort of a totally different follow-up to On Tyranny. Whereas On Tyranny was, you know, went through 20 lessons about defending or preventing authoritarian rule, this one is more like a narrative. And he sort of goes through his life and his experiences in politics, studying politics, and he talks about freedom. He tries to define freedom, and he argues that freedom involves both care for others and an understanding of the constraints that shape our lives. And he argues that true freedom is not freedom from, but freedom to. And it's a positive thing. It's not a negative thing. It's not if you strip away the oppressive rule and the bars, that doesn't make freedom alone. You have to act to stay free, and you have to keep fighting for your freedom. We tend to think, okay, 250 years ago, Founding Fathers gained us freedom, and now we just have it. You don't just automatically have it. You have to constantly fight for it. And it's not just an individual right. It's also a collective responsibility that requires active participation in the democratic process. So, for example, he cites the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia in 1989, and it was a very large nonviolent uprising that united various social groups, and it culminated in ending 41 years of one-party rule in Czechoslovakia. He cites a lot of examples like that where ordinary citizens have gotten together and defeated totalitarianism and authoritarianism. I probably would recommend this book most out of everything today. It's very powerful, and he really, by relating it a lot to himself, he really brings the humanity into it. It's not just a philosophical discussion of freedom. It really makes you think about what freedom is to you and how what you can do to keep that.
Mm. And again, it is?
It is On Freedom by Timothy Snyder.
Thank you. David?
So my next book is from a Falmouth author that I went to high school with and also went to college with, Terry Suplat. who was a speechwriter for President Obama all 8 years, one of the longest serving speechwriters in White House history, and rose to the level of deputy director of that office. Terry wrote a book recently called Say It Well, Find Your Voice, Speak Your Mind, Inspire Any Audience. Now, that seems like an odd book for democracy, right? And so why did I pick this one? Well, I picked this one because in the public arena, whether it's elected, volunteer nonprofits, or bureaucrats like Arthur Fleming, you need to be able to communicate well in order to affect the change that is so necessary, either in an agency, an institution, or in democracy itself. And through personal stories that Terry tells and Say It Well, from the inside view of how words created action, and then sharing those in a way that helps other individuals to be able to inspire action in the audience. He's got this quick little list I'll read off of the 10 things. He says, effective communicators start with the story you tell yourself about yourself. So thinking of who you are before you communicate with others, kind of like Dwight Eisenhower said, America cannot bring to pass abroad what America cannot bring to pass at home, right? So we have to have our own story. So sit down and ask yourself these questions. Who am I? Where do I come from? What am I working toward? What's important to me? What are the values that guide me? What do I believe? Why do I do the work I do? What are my disappointments and fears? What do I hope to achieve in my life and work? How are my life and work perhaps an example of a larger story that can bring people together? I was honored to work with Terry to bring him to the John Kennedy Presidential Library to launch this book. It was the largest, over 400 people, the largest gathering since COVID at the JFK Presidential Library. And he admitted that night, and I didn't know this when we were setting it up for him, that he had never been to the John Kennedy Library before. It was his first visit, and what a visit it was. Over 1,000 people online. And Terry, again, has been going around the country promoting the book, Say It Well, Find Your Voice, Speak Your Mind, Inspire Any Audience.
We have an email from Gail from Eastham who suggests It Can't Happen Here by Sinclair Lewis, a 1935 dystopian political novel. The novel describes the rise of Brazilius Buzz Windrip, a demagogue who is elected president of the United States after fomenting fear and promising drastic economic and social reforms while promoting a return to patriotism and traditional values. After his election, Windrip takes complete control of government via self-coup and imposes totalitarian rule with the help of a ruthless parliamentary force, the manner of European fascists such as Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini. Gail, thank you for that suggestion. And like 30 seconds, Ray, go ahead.
Differ We Must, How Lincoln Society Succeeded in a Divided America by Steve Inskeep. We have so much to learn from Abraham Lincoln, his ability to work with both sides is so inspiring. You got me stressed. Sorry.
Yeah, we can learn
really
a lot.
Good book.
Yeah, it's a good book. It's a different We Must. Okay. Yeah. And again, we're going to have a link to all of the books we talked about here this morning a little later today at our website, capeandislands.org. Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich and Dave Vieira, Falmouth Town Moderator and State Rep. Thank you both.
Thank
Lots of
you.
Interesting
Thanks
books.
Thanks for having us.
We've got a big reading list here. All right. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.